From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The truth is, 2015 has not been a piece of cake for journalists. Good journalism never is easy. But this year, Donald Trump was a new kind of challenge in presidential politics. Black Lives Matter went at old assumptions as reporters took to the field. Mass shootings did too. Brian Williams took a fall. Others did great work. This hour on Point, the best and worst of journalism, 2015. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Where did you see journalism working well this year? Where did you see it falling down? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Three great readers and watchers and listeners with us this hour. Joining us from New York is Brian Stelter, senior media correspondent for CNN, host of Reliable Sources, author of Top of the Morning, Inside the Cutthroat World of Morning TV. Brian Stelter, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Also from New York, Max Linsky joins us, co-founder of Longform. It's a website celebrating long-form journalism, co-host of the Longform podcast. Max Linsky, welcome to On Point to you as well.
Hey, Tom.
And from St. Petersburg, Florida, Eric Deggans joins us, television critic for NPR, author of Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. Eric Deggans, great to have you right here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hey, there's plenty we can complain about and mull over and explore, and we will. Let's get some good stuff on the table first. Eric Deggans, when you look across the horizon, the landscape of this year, you watch, you listen, you see a lot. What did you think was good? What did the news media, if we can even discuss it in those terms anymore, get right, do well?
Well, what I thought was good was stuff that was under a lot of people's radar. There was a lot of good investigative reporting that was particularly done in newspapers and on some TV shows like Frontline. I'm here in St. Petersburg, Florida, where the Tampa Bay Times newspaper has done some amazing work exposing how local schools here became failure factories for black children. It's a series that has gained lots of prominence nationwide, mm-hmm. sort of dismantling how the resegregation of schools have disadvantaged black kids in this area. I really liked a ProPublica and Marshall Project story on how a woman who thought she had been raped was convinced by the investigation that she had made up the story and even recanted her story. And then when a serial rapist was uncovered, it turned out she had been raped.
Wow.
And it talked about how problematic it is how some police departments investigate rape. I really liked the way HBO's The Jinx and the podcast Serial kind of redefined nonfiction true crime reporting on television and radio and podcasting. So there was good stuff out there. You just had to look for it, I think.
Here's a little bit from The Jinx, HBO detailing the weird life of Robert Durst, the real estate heir in New York City. At the end of the 6-part documentary, he appears to confess to multiple murders. Listen closely.
What the hell did I do? Mm-hmm. Killed them all, of course.
What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course. Brian Stelter, there's a lot we want to ask you about, but remind us of these groups like ProPublica, the Marshall Project. What are these, and how are they getting involved in the news flow these days?
It is a blossoming of new news sources online, some of them for-profit, some of them not-for-profit. The Marshall Project, for example, is headed up by Bill Keller, the former executive editor of the New York Times. It has a focus on criminal justice issues, criminal justice stories. I would point out The Trace, which is a different kind of look at one issue involving criminal justice. It looks at gun violence. It is funded in part by Michael Bloomberg's Everytown gun group, but it tries to do what it says is independent journalism about the issues around guns. We've seen so many sites like this, like these, really sprout up in the past few years. 2015 was a good year for these sites, even as we see continued cutbacks in print journalism, especially at the local level. Unfortunately, this is once again layoff season. We've seen cutbacks at many newspapers from coast to coast and many in between. We continue to see those losses on the local level. But at the same time, this flourishing, this blossoming of new outlets, mostly online, dedicated to these topics like, for example, criminal justice.
And often nonprofit, and often Max Linsky teaming up with traditional news organizations to do investigative work, long form work.
Oh, yeah. And in the case of the story that Eric was talking about, teaming up together. I mean, that's actually a pretty interesting media story. That piece is incredible. And if you haven't read it,
The Tampa Times on failure factories, this one? No, I was talking about
the unbelievable story of rape. The interesting thing about that story from a sort of media perspective is that both ProPublica and the Marshall Project were working on it independently.
Wow.
Ah, yes.
And instead of trying to scoop each other, they decided to join forces, which is not something I feel like
a new day has dawned.
Yeah, in the for-profit media game,
never happened.
Coming together, and I think they would both say. I mean, I don't know this for sure, but I think they'd both say that the story was a lot better because of it.
What else is on your list?
What's interesting to me about this is that a lot of these new outlets that we're talking about have refugees from traditional news outlets.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, absolutely.
Brian talked about Bill Keller heading up the Marshall Project. You know, ProPublica has a lot of folks who worked in traditional newspapers and traditional media. So even as the economy forces these journalists out of jobs in traditional media, they're flocking to these new outlets. And the big question is whether or not it's economically sustainable.
Max, give us a couple off of your list of best of the year, a couple of projects or big stories that you put on that list.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are talking about how hard it was to find good journalism. For me, it was hard just to make to take anything off this list. I had too many things I wanted to put on.
Let's hear it.
Here's some stories that I loved. There was a piece called "The Talented Mr. Cotter," which was from Texas Monthly. You guys know Texas Monthly. It is one of the great true crime magazines of our time. And a wonderful young reporter named Francesca Mari wrote a piece about a con man, serial con man, who attacked a woman in Chile and is still on the loose, in fact, still pulling his scams all over the world. That piece stuck with me for sure. Another piece, but really her just her reporting over the course of the year, Rukmini Kalamaki in the New York Times has been covering ISIS in a way that's just fascinating. We actually had her on our podcast in February, and she talked about how she does her reporting, which is basically DMing on Twitter with ISIS. But she wrote a piece called "ISIS and the Lonely Young American" about a very isolated woman in Washington State who had been sort of befriended and recruited online by ISIS, and really gave you a sense, sort of away from the headlines, how that operation works and how they think about it. Another piece that I will not forget anytime soon, Joel Lovell in GQ writing a profile of Stephen Colbert just before he took over The Late Show. Celebrity profiles are easy to zing. It's not always the most hearty medium, but this piece was just incredible.
The late, great Stephen Colbert there by Joel Lovell in GQ. Brian Stelter, we'll come to what you liked. Where did you see the big potholes this year?
It's easy to say that the Brian Williams scandal was the biggest black eye for the press in 2015. In some ways, it was a symbol of a much wider issue. Brian Williams, of course, being suspended and then losing his nightly news job for exaggerating stories and perhaps for making himself too much of the story, but really for exaggerating a number of stories and being perceived as being untrustworthy. Trust and lack of trust in the press is probably the theme of the year. Donald Trump has helped make it so. Bernie Sanders has also helped make it so. Both of them critiquing the media from very different perspectives on the campaign trail and continuing this conversation about whether the press is up to the task and whether we are trustworthy. I'd like to think most journalists try very hard to earn the public's trust every day. But when something like a Brian Williams controversy happens, it does damage to the whole industry and has taken time to recover from.
This was Brian Williams with his first pass at an apology. He had said he was in this aircraft, was hit by RPG fire in the Middle East, had to take that back. Here he was on the air, NBC Nightly News. Of course, he's no longer host there.
I made a mistake in recalling the events of 12 years ago. It did not take long to hear from some brave men and women in the air crews who were also in that desert. I want to apologize. I said I was traveling in an aircraft that was hit by RPG fire. I was instead in a following aircraft.
Not the one under fire. Lester Holt is in. Brian Williams is off in cable land now. Eric Duggins, what did you end up making of that Brian Williams fall from grace there? How Lester Holt has stepped in, and Williams, is it a recovery now?
Well, you know, what's interesting about this situation, number one, this is the perils of being an anchor who does a lot of media that's outside of journalism. He basically, what seems to have happened is that he went on a lot of TV talk shows and made public appearances, and his story about this situation got a little more embellished. And then when it came time to do a story for the Nightly News that referred to his experience in Iraq, those embellishments made their way into his reporting, and people who were there who remembered the incident accurately responded. And so part of it is when you have the news anchor as a news personality, he or she has got to be careful about how they conduct themselves when they're not on the newscast, which is a kind of a new idea. Also, Lester Holt came in and made the best of an awful situation. He came in and sort of steadied the ship on NBC Nightly News, a longtime substitute host and backup host. He became the first Black man to solo anchor a network TV newscast. The ratings have done as well or better under Brian Williams. And so there's a sense that he came in, righted the ship, and made history in the process, also showing perhaps how the broadcast itself can survive when the anchor stumbles.
Not so personality tied there, maybe. Holt's done a good job. Brian, what did you make of the dynamic behind Brian Williams' fall? Was this a kind of blurring of the lines between newsman and personality?
Certainly there is, although it's hard for me to critique that too much because we see that across the media landscape, yeah. And we see more and more of that commonly. But I agree that this is an example of the personality not mattering as much as the news itself, the newscast itself. It was a reminder that you can move a new anchor in, and actually the newscast is doing better. It's remarkable the audiences are holding as steady as they are, actually. Predictions about the death of the Nightly News continue to be exaggerated. If anything, old media in 2015 had a number of wins. We're seeing newspapers like the New York Times come up with new subscription revenue models. We're seeing television newscasts continuing to drive big audiences. Yes, new media is flourishing, but old media not going down without a fight.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about journalism in 2015, best and worst of the year. You can join us this hour. What news reporting most spoke to you this year? What journalism enlightened, informed you, helped you see the world? What journalism made you cringe, made you crazy? And did good reporting take you right to the Syrian refugees, to understanding the anger in Chicago and Baltimore? Where did journalists let you down? On the streets, in the presidential campaign? When they poured into Syed Farouk's apartment in San Bernardino, maybe? We're joined today by Brian Stelter, senior media correspondent for CNN, host of Reliable Sources on CNN, author of Top of the Morning. Eric Deggans is with us, television critic for NPR, author of Race Baiter. And Max Linsky is here from Brooklyn, co-founder of Longform, website curates and celebrates long-form journalism, co-host of the Longform podcast. And I should say we've got a lot of the good and bad that we're pointing to this hour up at our website, onpointradio.org. We've got a lot to look at, callers as well. Jim calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. The best journalism of the year was you. You're bright, you're objective, you have great stories. Congratulations on your podcast award.
Oh, thank you.
The worst journalism was the first Republican debate hosted by Fox. It was like a reality TV show, and I think they were doing it for their own ratings.
Wait, you mean the one with Megyn Kelly, where she tangled with Trump?
Yeah.
And all? I thought she was pretty good. I thought she was pretty tough on the Republicans up there that night. You didn't think so?
She may have been, but still, it was all about ratings, I thought.
All right, let's go straight to the politics and the coverage of the presidential campaign. Let's start with the debates, I guess. Eric, how about it? Our caller Jim in Omaha, and thank you, Jim, but didn't like the Fox handling of that first debate. Now, things got to my ear and eye worse before they got better, if they got better. But how about the debates we've seen?
I don't know that I would have singled out the Fox debate in particular. I would say what has bothered me is the way in which these debates have been presented as sort of pugilistic contests, mm-hmm. and some of the ways in which they've been advertised, and the cable channels that have presented them in particular. They see these as opportunities to make historic ratings. The Fox News debate was historically watched. CNN's two debates were the two most watched nights of its history. So, of course, there's this focus, I think, on not damaging that and on protecting that and encouraging that. And it has transformed these debates from public service opportunities to TV events that are about ratings and revenue and advertising. And I think that has distorted many of them. I wouldn't necessarily single out the Fox News debate, to be honest. I do feel we need to get back to the idea that we should not be caring, the people who are presenting these debates should not be caring so much about the ratings of them and should be more focused on the fairness of them.
Brian, you're at CNN. Of course, they've hosted. Is it like Fight Night on HBO when the party debates come on these days? Republicans have had a lot of candidates up there. Maybe it's inevitable that there's a scrum.
Well, admittedly, I do work for CNN, but I think to the extent that the commercials have presented these as fight nights, they may be taking their cues from the candidates, themselves and what the candidates are saying on the campaign trail. We have seen, of course, for the last 6 months, the Donald Trump show. That has been what our election has been about. And he has driven this into a more personal, in many ways, more ugly campaign season. I think the point about the ratings is significant. You know, just to put it in context, 8 million viewers watched the Democratic debate over the weekend. In any other primary cycle in history, that would have been a huge success. But actually, in this cycle, that was pretty disappointing because we've seen 18 to 20 to 25 million viewers watching these debates.
But of course, it was Saturday night, eggnog night, last Saturday before Christmas. Everybody
indeed,
said they tried
indeed.
To bury it.
In fact, maybe the 8 million was higher than people were expecting. I think the moderators we see on stage, whether for CNBC or Fox or CNN or ABC or CBS, they're not thinking about the ratings. They're thinking about trying to challenge these candidates. Obviously, executives do think about ratings, though. When I think about the questioning at that first Fox debate, it was very pointed questioning. I think it's what viewers wanted to see. I'm not sure it's what the candidates wanted to hear. We've seen a variety of styles at these debates, and we'll continue to, I think, in the new year. But if I had to say one thing about the election coverage, I'd say that there has been tough questioning of Donald Trump. However, there has also been a whole lot of entertaining coverage, a whole lot of silly coverage. And it's more than ever incumbent on the audience to go and pick out the kind of coverage, the style of coverage they want. You know, I think there's been really sharp pieces written about Trump, but sometimes that they've been lost in the huge pool of nonstop coverage of what he says every day. You know what I mean?
If I could interject real quickly,
yes, what bothers me the most is we've entered this cycle, particularly in the morning news shows and on cable news, where Donald Trump says something outrageous and then it is simply reported. And at some point, Donald Trump's candidacy is fueled by his media presence, fueled by the fact that he seems to be ubiquitous in TV news. So if we enter into this cycle where every time he says something outrageous, there's a clip of it, and then there's a little story about, hey, can you believe this outrageous thing that he said about Hillary Clinton now is in the cycle. Now we have come to realize that that is a very damaging cycle. And I think journalists need to put the brakes on this and do
but
stories about Donald Trump when they're substantive.
The alternative is to insist on
substantive stories and not necessarily talk about Donald Trump every time he says a profanity in a speech.
Yeah,
but if he says
ban Muslims from entry to the United States temporarily.
I'm not talking about that.
Okay.
I'm talking about the story that's in the news cycle right now where he said some profanity about Hillary Clinton and he said something about her bathroom break. And it is a major story on the morning news shows. I don't understand that. I don't think it's necessary. And if you're going to do that, you have to provide more journalism than just repeating what he said and talking about how crazy it sounds.
It's kind of
that gets back to something that Brian was just saying, right?
Yeah.
Which is, were the moderators really not worried about ratings? And are the morning TV hosts really not worried about ratings? It feels to me like that's a very difficult cat to put back in the bag. So once you know that Trump swearing in a stump speech is going to get you clicks or ratings, it's pretty hard to stop doing that. And I think that's the cycle we're in, is that once you've reached that level, You don't want to drop off, even if you know it's kind of cheap.
But we're talking journalism, and I think Eric is exactly right. If you go out and use a Yiddish profanity, and that becomes the top of the news. I mean, on the other hand, you've all described how the candidates are pushing back as well. Trump has pushed back. Bernie Sanders has pushed back on the media. I want to look at both of those for just a minute here. This was Trump in November giving a really pretty angry freewheeling speech in Fort Dodge, Iowa. Here's part of the speech where he attacks the media.
I don't have to do interviews, which I don't like doing, to be honest with you. I can leave this scum back here at the press alone. I don't need them anymore. They're garbage. No, they're scum. I don't have to deal with them anymore.
Scum, garbage, scum, Trump calling the news media. But here's Bernie Sanders. This was in August talking to reporters after a speech in Dubuque, Iowa, and responding to a reporter's attempt to get him to say something about Hillary, against Hillary.
The corporate media talks about all kinds of issues except the most important issues, okay? And time after time, I'm being asked to criticize Hillary Clinton. That's the sport that you guys like.
That's the sport that you guys like. And his handle there is the corporate media. Brian, corporate media, garbage, scum media, getting attacked from a couple of angles there.
I'm glad you played this, Anderson. I think it's really important. He's the only candidate on the trail who talks this way, who uses the phrase corporate media. It's a cousin of the phrase mainstream media you sometimes hear Republicans use.
But more corporate pointed, media, sharper.
I think it's really important that he uses this phrase because it does make people think about the role of media in our society. It reminds them that not all media is corporate media. Right now we're on NPR after all. And it challenges the press to cover issues in a more substantive way. He says it oftentimes on the campaign trail. In many ways, he is a media bashing candidate like Donald Trump, but for very different reasons.
Where does this go, Eric, if we get the Sanders attack on the media, corporate media, the Trump attack? I don't know if you'll keep that up, but garbage, scum. Does that change the reporting?
I don't know. I do think that Bernie Sanders is trying to make a point that a lot of his supporters are also making, which is that he's alleging that there is an understanding amongst established media outlets that Hillary Clinton is the preferred candidate and the likely winner, and their coverage is enabling that prediction to become reality. Mm-hmm. And so that is an argument that speaks directly to his base in a way that's very effective. Sanders' problems with coverage is what we've talked about before. Trump is a lightning rod for ratings and attention because he says outrageous things that are easy to place inside a web text or a TV show or some kind of report that will get a lot of attention online or get a lot of viewers on broadcast. And Sanders is almost the polar opposite of that. And he's not, I think he's not getting in part the kind of coverage that he wants because he is not the kind of exciting figure that Donald Trump is. And again, it's up to journalists to sort of bring our professional sensibility to this and understand that values of entertainment are being used to sort of pollute our reporting.
You should not have to be a reality TV host to do well in a presidential campaign.
No, but I would say the candidates could learn. Other candidates could learn from Donald Trump, from his entertaining style. I don't think the Trump story is about Trump, though. The Trump story is about Trump's supporters and what's happening in the country among his supporters. And that's one of the reasons why he's getting so much attention, although it's obviously easy to say it's excessive when compared to the other candidates.
Do
you guys think that Trump is right that he doesn't need the media anymore?
No. I mean, it's a giant megaphone. It's magnifying everything. Of course he needs it, but there's an attitude there that's working for him politically. The press pushing back at some points on the Donald Trump talking about a ban on Muslim entry temporarily to the country. Tom Brokaw, special correspondent for NBC News, of course, former big anchor, talked about that.
Trump's statement, even in this season of extremes, is a dangerous proposal that overrides history, the law, and the foundation of America itself. In my lifetime alone, we have been witness to the consequences of paranoia overriding reason.
Max Linsky, what do you think about that kind of judgment on Trump's statements from Tom Brokaw? This campaign season may call more of that out. That is an unusual broad judgment on a standing candidate, but Brokaw felt compelled to make it. Do you expect we'll see more of that in 2016? Does this campaign require that, Max?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think when the campaign started, people didn't take it seriously. I think the media didn't take him seriously. The narrative was he's going to fade, and the question was when. And it's, you know, December 22nd. He's still leading most polls. And it's getting serious. And people are trying to play catch up. And I think that's what that is about, is trying to sort of ring a bell that says, okay, we need to take this seriously now.
You got Ben Smith.
Well,
of course,
I would say New York University professor Jay Rosen did an interesting piece where he talked about how what political reporters often do is present what the candidate says and then present some counter-narrative, or they look into the facts or whatever, and then they let the audience decide what that means about the candidate. Mm-hmm. So if the candidate says something that's untrue and they find a way to report the facts, then they let the audience decide whether or not that guy lied. But we have reached a point with Trump where he is beyond that kind of reporting, and we are seeing some outlets like BuzzFeed and like the Huffington Post and even Brokaw, and I think Richard Engel from NBC also said some things where they are drawing conclusions, and they are saying, you know, we feel that this guy is racist, or we feel that this guy has crossed a line in a way that we're not just going to report what he said and then report some facts and let you make up your mind. We're also going to say what we think about this. And
but
so
of course
this
that
is media outlets trying to figure out how to deal with a candidate like Trump, who seems to almost operate in a fact-free zone at times, saying what he believes to be true, even when it's demonstrably provable that what he's saying is not true.
I want to quote from that piece by Jay Rosen. Of course, this is a memo from Ben Smith, editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed, talk about the in the new, not new anymore, but big crop of new digital players here. And Ben Smith put this out to his staff at BuzzFeed, and he said, we've gotten a question or two about how to talk about Donald Trump in social media and whether calling him, say, a liar and a racist violates our policy asking you not to be politically partisan on social media. Ben Smith goes on to say to his staff, it is entirely fair to call him, Trump, a mendacious racist. He says, I would steer away from suggesting his views are those of all Republicans or conservatives. Dick Cheney condemned him, and he, of course, he did at that time. But then says, but there's nothing partisan about accurately describing Donald Trump. Brian, that's the kind of sweeping judgment that I think a lot of journalists for many, many years stayed away from. Maybe Trump takes us there.
It absolutely is the kind of judgment that people have stayed away from. And I think it's the kind of judgment that Trump supporters see and then say, oh, Trump is right. The media are scum. These people are against us. Whether we agree with that or not, that's the kind of evidence that Trump supporters seize on. I think two things are important about Trump coverage in the press. Number one is the fact-checking. We've seen a lot of fact-checking. There's been a lot to fact-check, of course, and I've been impressed by the fact-checking efforts at a number of different institutions. It's been very clear from Glenn Kessler at the Washington Post and PolitiFact and others when Trump is speaking in ways that are completely not supported by evidence. I would also say, though, that there's a whole ecosystem of conservative media outlets that we have to pay close attention to in the coming 11 months until the election, because they are reinforcing and supporting Trump and other candidates when these candidates are wrong. That ecosystem is becoming more powerful or more effective. When Trump made his misstatements about 9/11, about the thousands of Muslims he said were cheering in New Jersey, which did not happen and it is not true, we saw conservative media support Trump, provide what felt like, looked like evidence, but was not evidence. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Trump used those websites in order to defend his position. In fact, even yesterday on the Today Show, he said, I'll send you the Breitbart headline that proves I was right. Trump was not right, but he has sources that tell him he's right. And that is disturbing for our news media ecosystem.
Jeff in Nashville, Tennessee. Jeff, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It seems to me that one of the things that concerns me is that, especially on CNN, but that's probably because that's the station I listen to the most, when there is an update that an anchor person's asking a reporter to give, a lot of the times there is no update. But what we hear are phrases such as, from the reporter, as, it's not clear if, or the question I have is, or there's much more to be answered on this. And the last one that I've heard is, this raises other questions. So what we're left with is an expanded series of questions without a response. And somehow this is being interpreted as news. And I think part of it seems to be that there's such a thirst or a demand to have an immediate reporting on some of these things when there is nothing to report. that it's a false sense of what news is really all about.
Jeff, I promise you we will pick that up right after a short break. You want answers, not questions. On the other hand, if people force answers too quickly, they may be straight up wrong. We can understand and appreciate caution on that front. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about journalism in 2015, best and worst of the year, with Eric Deggans of NPR, Brian Stelter of CNN, Max Linsky at Longform. You can join us. What has served you from the news media or beyond the formal news media this year when it comes to understanding the world? What has not? There was a lot of shock when the apartment in San Bernardino where the shooters had lived was suddenly open and news media were pouring in. Here's MSNBC, among others, were in there in San Bernardino. There's a little bit of that live interaction, the whole country watching between reporters in the field, in the apartment, and host back in the studio.
Let's make sure we don't.
Okay, here's the
let's make sure we don't see the children. Let's not show the child, Carrie.
And I'm sorry, Andrea, this is sort of unfolding live as we're doing it, so I'm not sure what the next picture is going to be until I pull them open. All right, so we've got quite a number of pictures of children here. Again, it's...
I think we should...
Okay, we're going to step away from the pictures for a moment. Why don't we go to the...
Let's see in the other side of the next room.
Eric Deggans, easy for radio people to complain about that, but what did you make of that moment when television cameras poured into that apartment and there were family pictures and all the rest lying all around?
Well, in a way, this sort of connects back to the earlier point that your caller made. The pressure to report immediately and in real time on television, even when you're not fully aware of the full scope of the story. Ideally, what Kerry should have done, and Kerry Sanders from NBC News, I've always admired his work as a reporter. I've known him for a while. He's based here in Florida, so I don't want to disparage him too much, but this is a symptom of a larger problem. Ideally, what he should have done was gone in there, filmed everything, looked through everything, and then they could have edited down the footage to make a story that was informative and blocked out all the information that you wanted to block out.
But how does he do that when everybody else is live in there too, though?
Well, I think they were the only TV news outlet that was broadcasting live. And the problem was that there were photos of people who were just friends of this couple, kids who were friends of the family or something. They weren't directly involved in this situation, but suddenly their photos were splashed all over this story in a way that even the reporter couldn't anticipate because he was discovering this information as he was broadcasting it to a nationwide audience. And in a situation like a terrorism investigation where there's so much that's not known and there's so much prejudice and stereotyping and people afraid of religion and afraid of ethnicities, you have to be very careful about what you're reporting. And I imagine we're going to wind up talking about another instance where the New York Times made a huge mistake in covering this story and also sort of fed into some of these political dynamics and these concerns and fears about terrorism.
Well, we may get there right here. Brian Stelter, our caller from Nashville, saying he doesn't want so many questions. He wants more answers. He doesn't want to see CNN or other reporters saying it's not clear if, or the question I have is answers, not just questions, please. On the other hand, the Times got out front on the San Bernardino story on the social media side and got it wrong. Oh, what about that tension, Brian?
Watching the news gathering process has never been pretty, but now we're more able to watch it than we ever were before, right? Via Twitter and via Facebook and via live television news. So we're being confronted more often by the ability to watch things happen in very much in real time. And that is not always something that that's very attractive, right? It requires a different kind of media literacy when you're hearing information that's very raw. And that's only going to become more common in the future as we see live video apps like Periscope and Meerkat and Facebook's live video service becoming more prominent. It's best when anchors, when correspondents simply say there's a whole lot we don't know. I saw many cases of that during coverage of mass shootings this year where the anchors were transparent with the audience about what they did not know. That's the most effective way to handle those situations, I think. But with the Times, a big mistake on the front page. They said that the one of the shooters in San Bernardino had been openly talking about jihad on social media. Turns out it was happening in a very private way online, not in a public way. And that was because of anonymous sources, because of government sources that were wrong, that were giving wrong information to the Times. Now, in some ways, we're only as good as our sources, but there has to be a greater level of scrutiny when information is being passed along by anonymous government sources, when you don't know their agendas, and when you don't know where they're getting the information from.
Jim, let me ask you about a dynamic that's gone on for some time now. But here's a listener, Jim, on Twitter, puts it to you. He says, how does Mr. Stelter justify CNN saturation coverage like Paris and San Bernardino? It fans emotional flame and burns reason. I think we understand why TV goes all out on those. And yet, he and some others here are saying, does that take the place of a kind of more careful, insightful reporting or reasoned handling of subjects when it's all about the drama of the event?
I would say that Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say that I would push back a little bit on this notion that anchors saying they don't know something is adequate enough, because what happens, and we see it all the time, is these is anchors come on and they say, well, we don't want to speculate, but, and everything that comes after that but is speculation, and the viewer winds up absorbing it just like it's factual material. So one of the problems that we have is that people are pretending they're not speculating when they are, that people are pretending they're not reporting what they don't know when they absolutely are. And we need stronger resolve to not say what you don't know. For example, when the San Bernardino shooting first became an emergency, one of the things that we all know, because unfortunately we are so familiar with live coverage of mass shooting events, is that the number of shooters that we are told is often wrong. We know this from Newton. We know this from many other shootings.
In early reports.
And still and yet, we had people reporting confidently that law enforcement was saying there were three shooters. And we found out much later that that was wrong. And I think what we have to do is use our experience that we've seen how bad the reporting can be in the immediate aftermath of emergencies. And we have to bring that to our new reporting. We have to restrain ourselves. And we have to stop being addicted to the rush of attention and wanting to hold that audience and wanting to make sure that we are the people who get the credit for everything, because that's when you make the biggest mistakes.
Brian, what about this concern?
It's the public. It's the public that wants that information. And maybe not everybody, but many people want to be able to experience events in real time. The anchor, the reporter, holds the viewer or holds the listener's hand in moments of crisis. And that's not something going away. If anything, that's going to increase. So it's incumbent to some extent on the audience to understand that some of the information is going to be incorrect, and for the anchor to continually reinforce that as well.
But public appetite, appetite shouldn't be the overriding sort of guide to how journalism is done, right?
I mean, for sure, for sure.
What about our listeners' complaint or concern that saturation coverage can drive out detailed, in-depth reporting, Brian?
I think the internet has changed everything. The internet is now the primary medium for the world, but especially in the United States, it is where most people consume most information. And on the internet, you can get everything. You can get those deep dives. You can get those documentaries made years later about an event. But you can also get that real-time, instantaneous, unfortunately sometimes incorrect coverage. I think what we see a CNN or a Fox or an MSNBC choose to cover one story at a time, in part, the networks are doing it as a reaction to the internet, because the headline news format of the past is no longer relevant because you can get all those headlines on the internet. So you cover one story at a time or two stories at a time because that's something that is a way to stand out and differentiate. That can be both a business as well as an editorial decision. I agree that it can sometimes heighten people's anxieties. It can sometimes create an over an overstated sense of importance to a particular story. But you have to keep in mind also that most viewers aren't watching all the time the way that, well, for example, I do.
Matthew in Miami, Florida. Matthew, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Happy holidays to you all.
You too.
My point and my question is I want to ask about something that I saw happen earlier this year when one of the media outlets in one of the municipalities, after a shooting, When the event was taking place, they used the suspect's name. But once it was over, they stopped using his name in order to cut down on copycat. And we saw, from what I understand, after, at least initially, back to Columbine when I was in high school, that the copycat incidence was much higher after these events because of use of killers' names. And thank you.
Turn away from the user's, the shooter's name. Eric, what about that? I've heard that again and again right here, listeners saying, let's not give these people so much attention. On the other hand, people want to know what happened. Who did this?
Right. And again, when you have a situation like the San Bernardino shootings, law enforcement also wants to know from the public, you know, what was going on with these people? Did you see them somewhere? Is it possible they may have left devices in other places? They're also interested in getting out the news of who these people were so they can find out more about them. I do feel like that cat is kind of out of the bag. And I think it would be really hard to get news outlets to not identify the people at the heart of these mass shootings, because that's the central question that viewers have, is who were these people and why did they do what they do? We've already seen some pushback, for example, on the long-held conventions of not detailing suicides and not naming people who were victims of sexual assault. There have been some very ethical and very, you know, capable journalists who have made the argument that our conventions surrounding these incidents can do more harm than good because the public isn't adequately informed about situations when they happen, or they're unfairly informed. Some suicides get a lot of detailed reporting and others are never remarked upon. So I think this is a difficult ground to parse. And I, in particular, as a journalist, am always in favor of more disclosure rather than less.
Let's go to Nona in Tovola, Michigan. Nona, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am an NPR junkie, and I want to sing the praises of two of your female reporters.
Yes, please.
Lourdes Garcia Navarro, when she was in the jungles of Amazon and with the tappers, the rubber tappers.
Yes, and taking out the rainforest. Wasn't that a great series? And I don't know if you caught it, but we had her on right here for an hour. That was terrific in the field reporting.
I listened to that. I listened to everything. And then I also, she was so brave. And then I also, that Eleanor Beardsley is a crackerjack. They are two great reporters.
I agree. In Paris, and also when Eleanor was in Ukraine the year before, both terrific. Nona, I appreciate your call. Elaine in Cohasset, Massachusetts. Elaine, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Just wanted to say that I understand why a lot of us, the public, is negative on the media. I think we all become these dubbed junior reporters ourselves. We all have blogs, Twitter, etc. What I wanted to just point out and recognize and hear the panel talk about a little bit is the important role that those men and women journalists who sacrifice go into dangerous zones and places, and then, unfortunately, thinking of someone like James Foley, who goes back again just so that we can learn the truth and the importance of media, and that we need to get back to some of that and remind the public of the important role that that serves in our democracy.
James Foley, who, of course, was beheaded in the Middle East. Who wants to speak to that? Max?
Well, this is actually, I'm sorry, Brian, I worry about when I hear someone like Trump or other politicians attacking the press all the time. It takes away attention from the fact that there are many journalists in conflict zones all around the world. On my show this Sunday coming up, I have the head of NPR, the head of AP on, talking about how difficult it is to decide when to send a reporter into a war zone. Mm-hmm. And on this holiday season, we should keep in mind there are reporters like Jason Rezaian of the Washington Post who are behind bars. Jason's behind bars in Iran, has been there for more than a year and a half at this point, and all efforts to try to free him have been unsuccessful so far. These are the people, when Donald Trump calls media scum, he is not talking about these journalists.
Of course.
Just to get back to some best journalism of 2015, there's an incredible piece called Five Hostages that Lawrence Wright wrote in The New Yorker about some of these journalists. And I do think that's a story that's starting to be told and told really well. And part of what Lawrence Wright was able to do in that piece, and also we've seen some pieces like this off these shootings, is to take a long view, to take some time to go back to the scene of what was breaking news and try and tell a full, thoughtful story. The Post has done an incredible job. There are a couple pieces that come to mind where they've gone back to the scenes of shootings. Once in Oregon, there's an amazing piece called An American Void about the house that Dylann Roof was living in before the shooting in Charleston. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that's an important antidote to all these problems that we're seeing in the breaking news is the papers and the outlets that are going back and trying to tell the full story about the people who are left behind. And that's a story that I think too often goes untold.
One thing I would note too is I feel like in an age where so much media is at our fingertips, it is easy to take for granted the sacrifices and the dangers that some reporters endure in order to bring us this reporting. I still remember very vividly watching a report where Byron Pitts from CBS was with a group of soldiers who were pinned down by fire in Iraq. And to see that live was astonishing, but also very frightening because I know Byron and I think he's a great reporter, and I was worried for his safety. But there are reporters who endure this take on these kind of dangers all the time. And to hear some political candidates sort of shrug off the way that some governments may have aided in the killing of journalists is again another feature of this modern candidacy that I am astonished by and that gives me a sense that we take for granted the people who bring us our news from the most dangerous places far too often.
Eric, we've just got a minute here, and I wanted to get to this earlier, but race, it's been a big issue this year, and the way the press is handling it, whether in Baltimore or Chicago, in the shooting in North Charleston, how's the perspective holding up?
Well, I'd say two things are going on here that have surprised me. Number one, the Black Lives Matter movement and the effort to draw attention to unequal policing has put institutional prejudice and stereotyping and criminal and law enforcement on the table in a way I never expected. But I will also say that we're in a situation where we used to think that if you exposed racism or you exposed people who were not telling the truth, then the audience could decide for themselves and understand that what they were being fed. We're seeing now that that may not be enough. It may not be enough to just sort of expose people to the facts because in some cases it doesn't dissuade people from believing things that aren't true or from not recognizing the truth. When it's
the power of the facts, the assumption of that kind of fundamental to how the press has worked, we'll see going forward. Eric Duggins, television critic for NPR, thank you so much for being with us today, Eric.
Thank you.
All three of you guys, just great. Brian Stelter at CNN, thank you for joining us, Brian.
Thank you.
Max Linsky at Longform. Thanks, Max. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.